Alice, I do just need to warn you that in this episode, there are going to be some very naughty words.
Don't say you weren't warned.
Matt, you wanted to see me?
Yes. No need to sit down. We won't be long.
Oh.
Alice, I think we're going to make some changes here at British Scandal.
That is such good news. I was thinking the exact same thing. Freshen it up.
Yes, personnel-wise. Maybe move people out, move someone else in.
Yeah, I think I know who you're talking about. Not to name names, but Millie Chu, producer, yeah?
Well, actually, I was thinking more closer to home.
Ah, okay. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Exec producer Joe Sykes, yeah. We're on the same page.
Now, Alice, what I mean is we're moving you on.
Oh, gosh. So I'm kind of almost going into management from a host role, like a promotion up. I'll miss you.
Now, Alice, you're fired.
Ah. Now that I didn't see coming.
7th of July, 2022, 2:40 a.m, Downing Street. Boris looks around the room at his exhausted team. Some are slumped over the desk, snoring. Others wander around sipping coffee, desperately trying to stay awake. He rubs his eyes. He's exhausted. His head pounds and his body aches, but he can't rest. His premiership is crumbling. MPs have been resigning all day, one after the other. At the last count, it was 59, but the truth is he's lost track. His cabinet, or what's left of it, have asked him to resign, and the fight to replace him has already started. He rubs his forehead. Power is draining away from him by the minute, but he's not going to give in. He slams down his fist on the large oval desk, watches the sleepy faces look up, startled.
One of you fuckers must have something!
He watches people stretch and yawn. But nobody says anything. He looks over at the whiteboard, covered in scribbled options. None of them work. He gets up, walks to the window, listens for a few seconds to the rain. Tries hard to clear his head.
Prime Minister!
He glares at the aide, who squirms a little, then straightens up.
We've been through every option. We can't appoint a new cabinet. The party's against us. We can't call a snap election. There's nothing we can do.
He glares around the room. No one meets his eye. Silence engulfs the room. He turns and catches sight of himself in a mirror above the mantelpiece. He looks dishevelled, tired, old. He's had enough.
Get out, all of you.
As his aides shuffle out, he looks back out the window. Tall black lampposts illuminate the empty road outside number 10. The light blurs as he feels his eyes prick with tears. Through the haze, he sees the soft outline of Larry the Cat wandering down the street. He's chasing a fox. He hears it cry out as Larry hares after it. Boris turns back into the empty room. All of his loyalists are gone, as are his most trusted advisors. And he wonders, for the first time, is this the end?
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
From Wondery, I'm Matt Ford.
And I'm Alice Levine.
And this is British Scandal.
So, Alice, at the end of the last episode, it was high drama because Pippa Creer at the Mirror has got this story. She sent it to her editor. It's a story that could bring the Prime Minister down. What do you think's going to happen?
Well, if we've learned anything about Boris Johnson over this saga, it's that he's resilient. Nothing sticks to him, whether it's Darius Guppy, whether it's the Arcuri affair, proroguing Parliament, Cummings and Barnard Castle, hanging from a zip wire for who even knows how long. He's just someone that manages to brush off all of these things, which for anybody else, cumulatively, would definitely have been career-ending.
Yes, and although we know how this story ends, there was a period of time where we genuinely thought he might get away with it because he's had a life of just going from one scandal to the other, apparently unblemished.
But the rise and the rise and the rise could only last so long, right?
Exactly. This is episode 5, Them's the Breaks. 7 months earlier, 1st of December 2021, the House of Commons chamber. Pippa Creer walks up the wooden steps to the press gallery, settles down in a seat just above the speaker's chair, and adjusts her face mask. She's here to report on Prime Minister's questions, and it's going to be explosive.
I mean, the past year at British Scandal, we have often, if recording on a Wednesday, gathered around the old television set, like the fireside, and settled in for an hour of entertainment, haven't we, before recording?
It has been incredible. I think more people have watched Parliament in the last year than ever before. And we would regularly interrupt work to do it because we're cool.
But just an hour, we're professionals.
Oh, yeah. She looks around the room. It's a full house. Journalists and MPs are crammed into the creaking benches, the air crackling with excitement. A couple of colleagues in the row in front of her turn around to congratulate her. She smiles and thanks them. But as she takes out her notepad, her hands shake. A few hours ago, her article about last year's Number 10 Christmas party went to press. She's accusing the Prime Minister of breaking his own lockdown rules. If she's missed out any small detail, her whole reputation will be in tatters. She hears the Speaker of the House's voice boom out.
We now come to the Leader of the Opposition, Keir Starmer.
The Labour leader gets to his feet.
As millions of people were locked down last year, was a Christmas party thrown in Downing Street for dozens of people on December the 18th.
She leans forward. Her heartbeat thuds in her ears. She watches the Prime Minister rise leisurely, putting his full weight on the dispatch box. From the press gallery, she can see where his blonde hair is thinning.
Mr. Speaker, what I can tell the right honourable gentleman is that all guidance was followed completely at number 10.
Pippa's stomach drops. The chamber erupts. MPs shout at each other across the room. She tries to speak, but it feels like she's been winded. One of her colleagues turns to her, shocked.
Did he really just say that?
Pippa can't believe it. A flat-out denial is almost unheard of in politics. And politicians only do it when they're on very solid ground. Her mind races as doubt begins to creep in. Could she have missed something? Over the next few days, she watches in disbelief as a succession of ministers deny her story.
If a formal party had taken place, then of course it would be wrong. But these reports are based on unsubstantiated, anonymous claims.
First of all, it's the Mirror. You've got to take that into account. And you're assuming that the news report you're referring to is accurate.
You would be absolutely, to use the journalistic term, shitting it. Wouldn't you be so petrified, even though you know you've done your due diligence? But you would think, if everyone's denying it, what does this mean for me?
Yes, and everyone happens to be the Prime Minister and the most powerful people in the land. So you must be doubting yourself the whole time, even when you're as sure as you possibly can be. Pippa sits at her desk at home, poring over her notes. She's exhausted, but spends hours going over and over every last bit of her source material to check for any mistakes. Finally, she sits up. Everything checks out. Every last detail. No matter what the Prime Minister said, or his ministers, her story's solid. She feels anger building inside of her. Members of government have broken the law and are lying to the public about it. It's a total betrayal of the British Constitution. She won't let them get away with this. She's got the evidence she needs. She's going to hold them to account. And when the time is right, she's going to strike back. 1 week later, Tuesday morning, Daily Mirror offices, London. Pippa stares at her computer screen. She's watching yesterday's footage of Boris Johnson talk to a reporter in Liverpool. It's the early hours of the morning and still dark. He's standing next to a police van. He's wearing a police waterproof jacket and a beanie. Tufts of blonde hair splay out under the hat, which is perched precariously on his head. A Tory blue tie peeking out of the bottom of the bulging police vest. And he's talking about drug crime.
We're ramping up our campaign against the County Lines networks that are preying on these users.
The Tory government have just announced Crime Week, a last-ditch attempt to introduce new drugs and policing strategy. Pippa takes in the image of Boris, the law enforcer, watches as he jogs over to a group of police and stands behind them as they swing a battering ram into a door. The camera follows him as he squeezes down the front hallway, scrambling to keep up with the officers. Pippa switches it off, leans back and sighs. Since her article landed a week ago, it hasn't made the impact she'd expected, and she's struggling to figure out her next move. She gets up to stretch her legs, wanders around the room past rows of desks with people busy at their computers or on their phones.
Pippa, come here! You need to see this!
Across the room, her colleague frantically waves her over. Pippa runs to her desk and peers down at the Twitter feed on her screen. She watches as Boris Johnson's press secretary, Allegra Stratton, leans on a lectern between two Union Jack flags. Pippa's colleague turns the volume up. It's a mock press briefing. Listen to this. Stratton is being asked questions by one of Boris Johnson's staffers.
I've just seen reports on Twitter that there was a Downing Street Christmas party on Friday night. Do you recognise those reports? I went home. Hold on.
I remember this so clearly. It was just everywhere, wasn't it? For people who can't picture it, it was kind of like a dress rehearsal, wasn't it, that for some reason was being filmed in their shiny new room.
That's right. They'd built a briefing room, so the government at the time wanted to have effectively like White House press briefings. And they'd hired Allegra Stratton, who used to be on ITV with Robert Peston, to do televised briefings on the record, something we've never had in this country. So they're using that room as the rehearsal space. That room has cameras. Someone filmed it. Eventually it got leaked. But those televised briefings never, ever happened.
In fact, that's the only one that we've ever seen.
This is it. Pippa turns to her colleague. Oh my God, when's this video from? December 2021, just a few days after the alleged party. Just wait, keep watching. Pippa turns back to the screen. The staffer is asking another question.
Would the Prime Minister condone having a Christmas party?
She watches Allegra glance away, smiling as she thinks for a few seconds before turning back.
Oh, what's the answer? Is cheese and wine all right?
Someone from the back of the room shouts no. Everyone laughs. Allegra grins, props her head on her hand.
This fictional party was a business meeting, and it was not socially distanced.
Oh, hearing you say it now and watching the video then, it's just so smug and it's just so gross. It's just making a mockery of everyone else's sacrifice.
And the problem is they constantly try to make out that they were in the right, that the law was on their side, that it was within the guidance. That footage proved they knew they were in the wrong. And the reason they're laughing is they know there's no credible answer they can give that will satisfy the public.
What's the answer, she's saying? What's the excuse? What can I possibly say to cover this? There's nothing.
You might as well have said, how do I lie to the public? Because that's what's going on. Pippa stares, open-mouthed, looks at her colleague. This is it. Boris Johnson's closest allies laughing and joking about a party he says never happened. This is the spark they needed. Where is this from? ITV. They've just released it. And it's already gone viral. Pippa watches the view count rise and grins. Boris Johnson can't flatly deny her story anymore. Now she's going to hit him with everything she's got. And this time, she knows it's going to stick. Tuesday, 3rd of May, 8:15 a.m., Downing Street flat. Boris crouches over the toilet bowl. He's been up all night with food poisoning. He's sweating and his stomach's cramping. He splashes cold water on his face, looks at himself in the mirror. He's desperate to crawl back to bed and sleep this off. But he needs to be in the Downing Street study in a few minutes. He's due to do a live TV interview with Good Morning Britain. Over the past few weeks, his reputation has taken a beating. Last month, he and Carrie were fined £50 each for his birthday bash. He's the first Prime Minister in history to be prosecuted in office, and the papers won't let him forget it. It's embarrassing. His only consolation is that Rishi Sunak also got fined.
Can you imagine that being your conclusion? Where's the true shame? Where's the actual contrition?
He's facing local elections in 2 days, and he needs this interview to go well.
Sir, as soon as you can, please. They're ready for you.
He straightens himself up, looks back in the mirror, ruffles his hair, then notices some sick on his lapel. He rushes back to the flat to change, feels nauseous again. He waits for it to pass, then fixes his Ukraine and Union Jack badge onto his lapel and heads to the study. Susanna Reid stands up to greet him. She's got an open, friendly face. She smiles, thanks him for agreeing to do the interview. He tells her he might need to run out to be sick.
If I hold up my glass of water, that means cut the cameras.
She tilts her head and nods sympathetically, tells him she hopes he'll be okay. Maybe this interview won't be so bad, especially if he can keep her away from Partygate. He straightens his tie, watches Susanna tell the camera,
"It's a crucial week as voters prepare to have their say in Thursday's elections."
Boris nods as she mentions that he's due to address the Ukrainian parliament right after this interview.
The first world leader to do so since Russia's invasion.
He plants his hands on his legs, feels himself relax as she turns to him.
Are you honest, Prime Minister?
His stomach grips.
I think you... Yes. Sometimes people say you lie.
This has taken a turn.
Usually like the first question's like an underarm, isn't it?
Yeah, on shows like this and like The One Show and stuff, because they've done a feature before this segment, which is often about something really incongruous, they'll be like, Prime Minister, we've just been talking about the plight of the native red squirrel. Do you have any opinions on the infestations in the garden?
Well, I'm a big fan of red squirrels, Alice, as you know, but I've got a place in my heart for grey squirrels too.
His heart races. He's being ambushed. He feels the heat of the lights, the cameras on his face. He looks at Susanna, but her face is set in a stony expression. He spends the rest of the interview trying to justify telling Parliament that all guidance was followed under lockdown. Desperately tries to turn the conversation back onto what his government has delivered for the British people. But Susanna cuts him off at every turn. As Susanna turns to the camera to round off the conversation, he makes a last-ditch attempt to save it, blurting out figures for crime rates. When it's over, he storms out, seething. In the corridor, one of his aides asks how it went.
A complete and utter clusterfuck.
2 days later, he's woken up by one of his aides. He rubs the sleep from his eyes, listens as his aide tells him the local election results are in.
We've made some losses, sir, as predicted.
He sighs.
Oh, how many?
He listens to the silence on the other end of the phone.
We're down almost 500 seats.
Oh.
He sits bolt upright. Losing 500 seats isn't a defeat. It's a massacre. 10 minutes later, he storms into his office in number 10. His aide runs to him.
Labour's taken some of our flagship councils, and some local councillors, or rather ex-councillors, aren't happy. In fact, they're calling for you to go.
He stops dead. He's always been a vote winner, not an election loser. He stares around the frantic room, looks up at the television screen at the live feed results, tries to take in the level of the defeat. He walks into his private office.
I don't want to be disturbed.
He sits at his desk, puts his head in his hands, and desperately tries to figure out how he's going to get out of this mess. Monday, 6th of June, 2022. Palace of Westminster. Boris strides through the corridors of Westminster, his head held high. He's on his way to a meeting with the 1922 committee.
What exactly is the 1922 committee?
It's just all the Tory MPs.
Easy.
Yeah. It was actually formed in 1923.
Annoying. Was that taken?
Since the Sue Gray report was released last week, calls for his resignation have reached fever pitch.
Sue Gray, who in the summer of 2022 was somewhat of a celebrity. I mean, I'm surprised we didn't see people dressed as the Sue Gray report for Halloween. It was that much of a cultural moment.
Never before has a senior civil servant cut through with the public like she did. So Sue Gray has done many reports in her life, but this one looked at 15 parties. Boris Johnson, it found, was at 8 of them, and some of the details appalled the public. People were so drunk that they were sick, fights broke out, there was wine up the walls. It painted a terrible picture of Boris Johnson's leadership.
This wasn't people who just had a little sip of wine while they were at their desk carrying on with their work, which was sort of how it was portrayed to the public, wasn't it?
Yes, if anything, it was the opposite. It painted a culture, not just that was very boozy, but that was disrespectful and, crucially, illegal. Yesterday, Boris got a call from the Grim Reaper himself, Sir Graham Brady, chair of the 1922 committee.
The threshold has been hit, Prime Minister. 54 letters. As a result, I'll now be calling a confidence vote in your leadership.
Boris knows his back is against the wall, but he also senses an opportunity. The rebels just might have made their move too fast. Because if he wins this vote, he can stay in power unchallenged for another year. He'll be safe, able to put Partygate to rest for good and have a mandate for the coming year. He's already met with his closest advisers to plan Operation Save Big Dog.
You know that whiteboard from a little while ago? Can we just go back to that and think of some other names?
Now he just needs to convince the 1922 committee to vote in his favour. He opens the oak-panelled door of the meeting room, looks up at the dark, imposing painting of Gladstone's 1868 cabinet hanging over Brady's head.
With five breasts. No, different series, different series.
The intricate swirls on the opulent green wallpaper and the group of backbenchers sat behind austere wooden desks who will decide his fate. He stays standing as Brady invites him to address the committee. He swallows hard. He has one shot at this.
I have to tell you I'm glad that this vote is finally taking place.
Boris notes the raised eyebrows around the room, but ploughs on.
Because we finally have the chance to stop talking about ourselves and start talking about what we can do for the people of this country.
Boris walks to the centre of the room, making a point of engaging every MP.
And you all know what an incredible force we can be when we are united. The people in this room won the biggest electoral victory for the Conservatives for 40 years under my leadership.
Boris feels the eyes of the committee on him. Some MPs are leaning forward. He's growing more confident in his speech by the second, counting off the achievements of his premiership on his fingers.
Look at the energy and drive we brought to ending the Brexit crisis. Look at the vaccine rollout. Look at the leadership we've shown during the Ukrainian conflict. And whatever else they may say about me, do you really think that anyone else could have done it?
He opens his arms wide, challenging anyone to reply. There's silence, but the power of his words reverberates around the room.
Let's show this country that we understand that this is a moment to unite and serve. Vote for me, and I will lead you to victory again!
With a flourish, Boris stands triumphantly at the centre of the room, breathing heavily. He feels like he's back at the Oxford Union all those years ago, a master among apprentices. For a few moments, the room is silent. But then there's a cough from the benches. Sir Charles Walker gets to his feet.
Boris, I have to say, there are times when you have driven me absolutely crazy.
As if on cue, an ooh rings around the room.
Okay, so we're at school.
A few MPs laugh. Boris laughs along, but he's suddenly nervous when Walker's face drops into a sombre expression.
However, defenestrating a sitting Prime Minister is a bloody, shocking, horrible and terrible thing. And we have to ask ourselves tonight, can we live with it?
A murmur goes around the room. Boris flushes with excitement. Maybe, just maybe, he can still pull through. That night, he stands with his team in the Downing Street Library, watches the live feed of the vote. He knows he performed well in front of the committee, but what if it wasn't enough? He holds his breath as Brady reads the results.
I can report as returning officer that 359 ballots were cast. No spoilt ballots. That the vote in favour of having confidence in Boris Johnson as leader was 211 votes, against was 148 votes. And therefore, I can announce that the Parliamentary Party does have confidence in Boris Johnson.
He watches the screen as MPs bang on the wooden desks, grins as people crowd around to congratulate him. He's done it. He's won. He's safe. The rebels played their hand too early, and now he's proved he still has a powerful hold over the party. This vote was closer than he would have liked, but he's going to put Partygate to bed, regroup, and prove to the country just what kind of leader he can be.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
June 17th, Kyiv, Ukraine. Boris runs down the steps of his plane, shakes hands with a waiting government official. They walk along a red carpet flanked by armed soldiers and step into a people carrier. It's his second visit to the country since the war started, and he's here to give President Zelensky his support. He gazes out at the bombed-out apartment blocks. Charred trees line the route. Every now and then, the driver swerves to avoid a bomb crater in the road. Yesterday, his senior aides had advised him against the visit. It wasn't planned, and they weren't ready with security. Besides, Prime Minister, you're giving an address at a conference in Doncaster tomorrow. It's fully booked. Everyone's expecting you. But he knows how crucial his support of Ukraine is to his career. In Ukraine, he is a strong and powerful ally. He's going to show not only the UK, but the world, that he is a serious leader who can rise above anything thrown at him. He's going to hit the headlines for more than just Partygate. His car pulls up outside the vast Mariinsky Palace. Zelensky rushes over and greets him warmly. He promises Zelensky he'll give Ukraine his full support. Watches his face crumple with gratitude. He follows him to the press room. Stands behind a cream and gold lectern.
So, Volodymyr, we're here once again to underline that we are with you to give you the strategic endurance that you will need.
A short while later, he heads out with Zelensky on a brief walkabout in Kyiv. They stop at an area that's been heavily bombed. He flinches now at the sound of shelling. looks over at Zelensky's armed guard for reassurance.
Boris, we love you!
He sees a woman leaning from a bombed-out building. He thought it was derelict, but now he can see faces everywhere behind broken glass. And he realizes people are waving at him. He waves back. He stands next to President Zelensky and takes it all in. And for a few moments, he feels like the leader he's always wanted to be. Serious, popular, internationally admired.
The cynical amongst us might think that the devastation in Ukraine was probably being used to his advantage to bolster his reputation, to give him the chance to be the hero.
Yeah, he definitely used it for political cover. But just it's so funny that he couldn't handle what was happening in Britain, so went to a war-torn country for a bit of sanctuary.
On the plane home, he closes his eyes. He's been attacked all year over the Downing Street parties. But that's over now. He's got work to do on the world stage. When the plane lands, he checks his phone. Sees a message from one of his northern MPs.
We weren't told you weren't coming until midday. You're burning up goodwill, Prime Minister. We hold your future. Don't forget that.
He puts his phone down. His visit to Kyiv was much more important than dealing with MPs from the so-called Red Wall. They'll get over it. He refuses to be held back by trivial infighting. He's one of the most powerful players in international politics. And he'll make his mark as the respected global leader he really is. 29th of June 2022, Madrid. Boris wanders round the Prado Museum, takes in the high curved ceilings and Doric columns. It's his last day in Madrid for the NATO summit. He's here for an official night of culture, and he's going to enjoy it.
God love him, he deserves it.
He stops in front of a Goya, Saturn devouring his son. He scans the painting with interest, taking in the maimed, decapitated body, disappearing into the cavernous depths of the god's mouth. The crazed eyes, the hulking, sinister form. A shiver runs up Boris's back.
How did they capture me so perfectly?
He turns away, moving quickly into a room of more palatable, neoclassical nudes. His mind drifts as he thinks about his time in Spain. This summit's been a success. He'd called for help for Ukraine and got the response he wanted. He's leading the international fight back against Vladimir Putin. And things will settle back home. Besides, he's got a lot to celebrate. He and Carrie are going to have a huge party at Chequers next month. They got married in lockdown, and soon they're going to celebrate their wedding in style. A few hours later, he's asleep in his hotel room when his phone rings. It's one of his aides.
There's been an incident involving Chris Pincher.
He sits up.
What do you mean?
He hears the aide clear his throat.
He was at the Carlton Club last night, got really pissed, and apparently he groped two men.
He hangs up, stares into the darkness, and lies awake for the next 2 hours. He doesn't want to lose Chris Pincher.
Okay, that's an interesting take.
He's loyal. Chris supported him through Partygate, and he still needs as many allies as he can get. But he doesn't need any more problems right now. Boris turns over. He'll ring Chris in the morning and tell him he has to stand down as Deputy Chief Whip. Later that afternoon, he steps out of his plane at Stansted, jumps into the waiting car and heads for Downing Street. He hopes now the whole thing is settled. But when he walks into the cabinet room, his senior aides look tense. One of them tells him,
"It's not just one man, Prime Minister. The press will ask whether you knew he'd done this kind of thing before."
He looks up, startled, tells his aide,
I didn't know anything.
Over the next few days, he watches his ministers do a series of interviews defending him. At 7:30 a.m. the following Tuesday, he's at the Downing Street flat making a coffee when one of his senior aides runs in.
Lord MacDonald's just published a letter on Twitter. He claims he told you about Pincher's behaviour in 2019. Is that true?
He stares, his mind whirring.
I mean, that was 3 years ago. I honestly can't remember.
For God's sake, Prime Minister,
cabinet ministers have been going out all day telling the press we knew nothing about this. They are going to think they've been lied to. What the hell were you playing at?
He watches his aides storm out. His heart is racing. Carrie walks in, holding the baby. She yawns.
Problem?
He pauses, considers her question. He knows what Carrie would tell him. Get ahead of the story. Take control of the narrative. He hates interviews, hates admitting he might have been wrong. But he needs to put this story to bed, once and for all. Fifth of July, Westminster. A production assistant is powdering Boris's forehead as he leans back and contemplates the room's gothic cornice and wood-panelled walls. He watches as the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason, sits down opposite. Boris glances to his left and sees a monitor cropped in on his face. The bags under his eyes are sagging, his skin flushed. He feels momentarily self-conscious, tries to flatten down his hair, then looks directly into Chris Mason's eyes.
Do you accept that it was a grave error to appoint Chris Pincher to your government? Oh, it was a mistake, and I apologise.
No matter what you think of Boris Johnson, he comes into his own in those moments like with the 1922 committee, where he needs to be rousing and dramatic. But what he's not very good at is sincerity.
Also, you know, when people say, look, I'm happy to apologise for that, you're like, well, apologise then. Well, look, I've said I'm happy to apologise. Say sorry now.
I want to make absolutely clear that there is no place in this government for anybody who is predatory.
The fact that you have to say it.
He sees Chris Mason eye him. Boris feels himself squirm. He knows what's coming.
But did you once joke, Pincher by name, Pincher by nature?
Boris tries to look contrite. He lowers his eyes, feels sweat building under his collar, mutters something about regret and hindsight.
Prime Minister, this is about truth. And we now know that those who've spoken for you over the past few days have said things that turned out to be untrue. Did you lie to them?
No.
When the interview ends, Boris clambers into his car, confident he's done enough to put the bloody Pincher issue to bed.
How many times have we heard that? Done and dusted, hands washed.
Half an hour later, he's back at Downing Street. He collapses onto the sofa in his office, exhausted. He eyes a cupcake on the coffee table. He's about to reach for it when he hears the door open. He instinctively sits back. He doesn't want Carrie to see him scoffing cupcakes at midday. But it's one of his aides. Without asking, he walks across his office and flicks on the television. Boris watches in confusion as cameras show Health Minister Sajid Javid crossing a street to his house. It takes Boris a moment to notice the headlines screaming from the bottom of the screen.
Sajid Javid resigns from government.
Suddenly alert, Boris watches in disbelief as the presenter quotes from Javid's resignation letter.
The tone you set as a leader and the values you represent reflect on your colleagues, your party, and ultimately the country.
The timing couldn't be worse. Javid hasn't even been in the job for a year.
Fuck him!
But before he can turn away, another breaking news story flashes across the screen.
Chancellor Sunak resigns from government.
Bloody hell, what a day. What a 2 minutes. These are the days we live for on Twitter, though, I'm just saying.
He can't believe what he's watching. It's a coordinated attack, a bloody mutiny. He watches as the presenter quotes a second resignation letter within minutes of the first.
The public rightly expect government to be conducted properly, competently and seriously. I recognise this may be my last ministerial job, but I believe these standards are worth fighting for, and that is why I'm resigning.
Over the course of the next few hours, Boris can only watch as one MP after another resigns. By the end of the day, he's lost count. And for the first time since becoming PM, he has absolutely no idea what to do. Later that night, Downing Street. Boris pushes away the empty pizza box, calls out for someone to bring him some bacon butties. He's been in this room for hours trying to figure a way to keep his premiership. And he's drawing a blank. He looks down, sees Michael Gove's name come up on the screen, fights the urge to fling it across the room.
That is just such a sort of honest and true response, isn't it?
A few hours ago, Gove had the gall to turn up with a delegation from the cabinet, demanding that Boris resign by 9 p.m. Even now, he's still livid about it. He glances at the clock. 8:59. He takes a deep breath and rings Gove.
Ah, Boris.
He feels a prickle of irritation at the cheerful tone in his voice.
I think you've made the right decision. You had to go...
Boris cuts in.
I'm not fucking going anywhere, Michael. You are. You're sacked.
Boris feels a swell of adrenaline as he listens to Michael falter on the other end of the phone.
What?
You heard me, you snivelling, disloyal invertebrate. You're out.
Respectfully, Boris, if anyone should be leaving, it's you. We're giving you ample time to...
But Boris cuts him off again.
Respectfully? Last time you were respectful was in Oxford, Michael. You're a bloody sneak.
He's surprised to hear Gove laugh down the line.
You're pathetic. Is that what this is all about? Our student rivalry? You can't let go.
Boris laughs manically, beginning to pace around the room.
Oh, please, Michael. You're a foot soldier, a droid, to do my bidding. That's what you've always been. Disposable. I didn't need you then, and I certainly don't need you now. So fuck off!
Boris throws his phone against the wall. He runs his hands through his hair, looks out of the window into the balmy summer night. The rush of getting rid of Gove immediately disappears. And Boris realises something. For the first time in his life, his charmed, lucky life, the life that has given him everything he's ever wanted, he's alone. He has no one, no allies, no power. Boris Johnson, the man, the myth, the leader, is over.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Seven hours later, Downing Street. Boris looks down at his notepad, reads over his speech, then tears it up. It's the hardest thing he's ever had to write. He leans back, looks around the room. One of his advisors is slumped over the desk, fast asleep. Another wanders round with coffee, looking shell-shocked. He's spent the night going over every possible scenario to save his premiership. But there was nothing. Eventually, Carrie had taken him to one side.
You need to go now, darling. It's the only way you keep any dignity.
He looks over at the window, watches the rain pour down the glass, then turns back to his speech. At 8:30, he rings Sir Graham Brady, tells him he's changed his mind and that he'll be announcing his resignation today. A few hours later, he puts on a dark blue suit, lets Carrie fix his tie. He watches photographers climb up scaffolding and position themselves on makeshift platforms. He feels like a man being led to the gallows. He hugs Carrie and kisses his children, waits until she's gone outside to join a group of his waiting supporters, then steps outside himself.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you.
He glances up, takes in the hushed silence.
In the last few days, I've tried to persuade my colleagues that it would be eccentric to change governments while we're delivering so much. And when we have such a vast mandate. He pauses, clears his throat, talks about getting Brexit done.
I want you to know how sad I am to be giving up the best job in the world. But them's the breaks. I know that even if things can sometimes seem dark now, our future together is golden. Thank you all very much.
He gives one last defiant look at the camera, turns and heads back inside. Staff applaud him when he walks in. He forces a smile and thanks them. He's agreed to stay until the party appoints a new leader. But he's reeling from shock at the way the party's turned on him. His whole career has been geared towards being Prime Minister. He should have been in office for a decade at least, leaving as one of the greats, not being thrown out in humiliation and defeat. He's not going to forget or forgive those that turned on him. But he's going to bide his time. Because in his heart of hearts, he knows that today is not the end of his role at the centre of British politics. October 12th, 2022. Broadmoor Hall Resort, Colorado Springs, United States. Boris stands behind a red lectern and grins out at his audience. He's at the Insurance Leadership Forum to give a talk. He's meant to be on holiday right now with Carrie and the kids, but he needs to earn some money. He throws up his arms and welcomes everyone, spends the next 30 minutes talking about his role in Brexit and his support for President Zelensky in Ukraine. Grins at the standing ovation from the audience. He's grateful for the money, but doing corporate Q&As is not where he imagined his future to be. He blinks out at the flashing cameras and tries to push down a bitter feeling of failure. Someone asks him about his successor, Liz Truss. Does he think she's going to last? He excuses himself and moves away. He doesn't want to comment on that in public. The truth is, he's been watching events at home with growing excitement. Her mini-budget has caused economic turmoil. The markets are unsettled, and so are Tory MPs.
Can you believe that we thought we were at rock bottom with Boris?
Not only did she flatter him as a leader, she made him look a better orator, a more responsible person. She flattered him in every way imaginable. He flies back to the Dominican Republic to join Carrie and the kids at the Casa de Campo luxury golf resort. Spends the next few days checking the news on his phone. Watches Liz Truss sack her chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng. Boris gets a steady stream of messages from excited supporters. The Daily Star are live-streaming her photo next to a lettuce to see who lasts longest. My money's on the lettuce.
I can't believe we're reporting this as history.
He gets a call from his old friend, Sir James Duddridge.
We need you back at the helm, Boris.
He leans back in his seat, sips his cocktail, and looks around the tranquil beach bar. Wonders how many days Liz Truss has left. He'll be on standby, just in case. And when the time is right, he'll launch the biggest comeback in history. Saturday, 22nd of October, Dominican Republic, Caribbean. Boris grabs his grey rucksack and shoves in a change of clothes. He needs to get to the airport fast. Liz Truss has just resigned, and the rush to replace her is on. He spent the last few hours on Zoom meetings to supporters and donors, trying to organise a campaign team. But his internet connection keeps failing, so now he's flying back to London. He spends the bulk of the flight working out his strategy. Under the new rules, he only needs the backing of 100 MPs. Then the vote will go to party members. He's been told that his grassroots support is still solid. In a few days' time, he could be back in the Downing Street flat, back as leader of the party and the country. After he lands, he heads to Millbank Tower, where Jacob Rees-Mogg and a small group of his supporters are waiting for him. Rees-Mogg holds out his thin hand for Boris to shake.
Ah, our Pericles returns. The campaign's going very well. We'll easily hit the threshold. And Rishi's agreed to speak to you at 3:30.
Do you know the true tragedy of this story is that we've barely had your Rees-Mogg?
Let's hope he's involved in a future scandal.
One can but dream.
He grins, looks around at the room full of people glued to mobiles trying to drum up support. This is where he belongs, right at the centre of British politics. And when he speaks to Rishi, he'll persuade him to do a deal. He'll go back as PM and he'll give Rishi the Foreign Office.
The arrogance of it, the entitlement.
Boris takes a few calls from prominent Tory members. They tell him he'll damage the party if he runs, that he's still under investigation for misleading Parliament. At 9 o'clock that night, he finally gets the call from Rishi. He excitedly snatches the phone up.
Rishi, we have much to discuss. I think we should...
But Sunak cuts in.
I'm going to stop you there, Boris. I wanted you to hear it from me. I've reached the threshold and therefore won't be doing a deal with you.
Boris stands open-mouthed as Rishi hangs up on him. He hunches over in bitter defeat, realises he's been played. It's over. He can't face the press. It's too humiliating. Instead, he writes a statement.
In the last few days, I have been overwhelmed by the number of people who suggested that I should once again contest the Conservative Party leadership. I led our party into a massive election victory less than 3 years ago. I believe I have much to offer, but I'm afraid that this is simply not the right time.
But Boris knows deep down that his time will come again. He's sure of it. He's Boris Johnson. He's a winner. And he'll be back. Stanley Johnson stood as a Conservative candidate for Tynebridge in 2005, but lost to the Liberal Democrats. In 2017, he took part in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. And in May 2022, he became a French citizen.
What a roller coaster.
Darius Guppy was jailed in February 1993 for 5 years after faking a jewel robbery in New York. A month later, he also pleaded guilty to a gold bullion smuggling operation between Britain and India. Michael Gove is still in the cabinet. He's currently Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities.
But is he?
By the time you listen to this, that may have changed. Rishi Sunak was fined £50 for attending Boris Johnson's illegal lockdown birthday party in Downing Street. He is currently the Prime Minister.
What an absurd collection of sentences.
Again, by the time you listen to this, that may have changed. Boris Johnson is still MP for Uxbridge and South Ruislip. In December, he will be the headline speaker at the International Symposium on Blockchain Advancements. The reported fee is almost £150,000.
Hello, Prime members. You can listen to British Scandal ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This is the fifth episode in our series, Boris Johnson.
A quick note about our dialogue. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said, but all of our dramatisations are based on historical research.
If you'd like to know more about this story, you can read Just Boris, A Tale of Blonde Ambition by Sonia Purnell, Chums by Simon Cooper, Blonde Ambition, The Rise and Rise of Boris Johnson by Nigel Cawthorne, The Gambler by Tom Bower, and Boris Johnson by Andrew Jimson.
I'm Alice Levine.
And I'm Matt Ford. Karen Laws wrote this episode. Additional writing by Alice Levine and Matt Ford. Sound design by Rich Evans. Script editing by James Magniak. Script consulting by Max Stern. British Scandal is produced by Samizdat Audio. Our associate producer is Francesca Gilardi Quadrio Corsio. Our producer is Millie Chu. The senior producer is Joe Sykes. Our managing producers are Tonja Thigpin and Matt Gant. Our executive producers are Jenny Lower Beckman, Stephanie Jens, and Marshall Louis for Wondery.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back.
We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some, But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.